Hello, I'm Garni Barkajarian of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute and CNS member for more than 10 years. What I love most about being a member is access to cutting-edge science and the opportunities that have advanced my career. I've also gained new colleagues and lifelong friends. Being a CNS member has been so rewarding. The value of membership cannot be defined by a number. Join me and the over 10,000 neurosurgeons who are making a difference in the world. Visit cns.org/membership podcast today.
Well, welcome everyone to our next episode of the Controversies in Neurosurgery podcast. I'm Seth Oliveira from the Oregon Clinic in Portland, Oregon. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Rashan Ali. And today's topic is open versus minimally invasive approaches for spinal fusion. And we're joined by our guest tonight, who is Victor Chang, who's from Henry Ford Health. So welcome, Dr. Chang and Rasha, first of all.
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for having me.
And so just to get us started, Dr. Chang, I think most of our listeners are at least exposed or are somewhat aware of the idea of open and minimally invasive spinal fusions. But where do you see that there's either in your own practice or just in general for spine surgeons, where do you see there's equipoise or controversy in applications of open versus minimally invasive techniques?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the past, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, there was a stronger dichotomy between surgeons who kind of considered themselves minimally invasive versus those who are strictly open. I think as the techniques have evolved and the goals of surgery have, you know, taken their own kind of shape, you know, as far as we're looking at sagittal balance and restoration lordosis, you see that there's a lot more kind of hybrid type approaches to some of these techniques. So, at least for planning operations, I think a good example is just with the lateral approaches, lateral techniques, either trans-psoas or anti-psoas approaches. You know, when they first came out, strictly speaking, they were considered minimally invasive operations. I mean, you know, part of it may have been like a marketing component from industry, to be honest, but I mean, the idea though is that you had a smaller incision. You didn't really violate too much of the, you know, posterior spinal musculature when you're approaching the disc space to treat the pathology. And, you know, in the beginning, you know, a lot of these surgeries were done without posterior fixation. So you would just have a very small incision on the side of your trunk, and you were able to get a pretty big interbody cage in. So as, you know, that technique was adopted and spread, you know, deformity surgeons saw that it was a pretty powerful technique for, you know, correcting coronal curvatures just because you release the annulus, you know, bilaterally. And so, you know, you see a lot of deformity surgeons, they'll stage an operation where they'll do a lateral approach. And then they'll do it the same way, like a minimally, like a quote unquote minimally invasive surgeon would do it. But then they would do a posterior open approach. You know, they might do some posterior osteotomies or a three column osteotomy if they need to. But you know, that approach, that lateral, you know, lumbar interbody fusion approach, has just become, you know, part of the tool set for, you know, any spinal surgeon. You know, doesn't matter if you're an open deformity surgeon or minimally invasive. It's just, it's available to be utilized, and you know, and been done quite successfully. So it's interesting how things have kind of evolved. You know, the other thing, things like you know, ALIF, you know, today I just did some lateral ALIF, and then that's, you know, it's kind of odd to think of an ALIF as a minimally invasive operation, but the operation itself has been streamlined to such a point where, especially with a lateral ALIF approach, you're going retroperitoneal slightly obliquely, and you know, you can get by with maybe like a 3 or 4 centimeter incision. And you know, the approaches I use, we're doing anterior posterior for an isthmic spondylolisthesis. So you know, you're doing a front back operation, you single position, I'm using a robot, you know, and these are patients that can be done, you know, I know some people try to do them in an ASC, but it can be done in a hospital setting where they go home the next day, which, you know, again, you know, the whole idea of minimally invasive is just, you know, it's kind of just being less disruptive, and it's the concept that's like in constant evolution right now. And so I think it's a bit of a moving target.
Sounds like in your practice, you're pretty commonly just combining sort of all the available techniques. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think, you know, in my practice, I'm a bit more, you know, it's almost like kind of like a religion, I guess. It's where you believe in certain tenets where, you know, I try as much as possible not to do like a midline exposure where you're stripping the muscles off the, you know, posterior elements. You know, even in revision surgeries, I'll do paramedian incisions just to get to the hardware directly, because I want to preserve those attachments of the multifidus on the facet, things like that. And so, you know,
and maybe just briefly for some of our listeners, why are you doing that?
Well, so the thought, I mean, so a lot of the driving thought from some of the original minimally invasive techniques is that, you know, when you think about the spine as an organ, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. You have the muscles supporting it. And, you know, traditionally, when we did like midline laminectomies, where you remove the spinous process, remove part of the set, that's essentially where the multifidus muscle has its insertion and attachment. And if you look physiologically, the purpose of that muscle is to help give stability to your spine by maintaining like a posterior tension band. When you think about, you know, biomechanically, you know, our anatomy, we're kind of like you know, you have these cantilever forces where, you know, your viscera, you know, everything's anterior to your spine. And so you have to have something posterior to the center of gravity of your spine to kind of help maintain that balance between, you know, all the, you know, contents in the anterior part of your body versus where your spine is. And so, you know, it's thought that the multifidus is a big part of that, especially in the lumbar spine. When you think relatively with the spine, you know, you have your cervical spine and your lumbar spine are mobile. The thoracic is relatively fixed. So in your thoracic spine, you have things like your rib cage and your sternum that kind of help you give it additional rigidity. But in the lumbar spine, you're basically counting on all of your axial musculature to help support in addition to the vertebrae and the discs.
And so, sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying that you very rarely disrupt that. You try to, you know, always come down, even on revisions, off midline.
Right. Yeah, as much as possible. You know, I think, you know, at least anecdotally, some people might disagree, but I guess, you know, this whole point of this talk, the podcast is controversies, is that, you know, the big kind of the, you know, the, you know, for when you look at open deformity surgery, kind of the core thing that they're wrestling with right now is just how to handle PJK, proximal junctural kyphosis. And, you know, I think there's been some, you look at the different workarounds where, you know, at your upper instrumented vertebrae, they'll do different types of tethers or, you know, kind of non-rigid fixations where you're kind of maintaining that tension band that you've kind of stripped off to do the exposure for your surgery. You know, there's been some studies where they looked at, you know, the muscle mass of the paraspinous musculature, you know, after an operation, just to see it, use that as kind of a morphometric predictor for PJK. So I think that the muscle that you have there, it matters. You know, when you look at the, you know, minimally invasive deformity type cases where maybe you're doing a bunch of inner bodies laterally or through like a mini open TLIF or what have you, and you're putting a lot of screws percutaneously, you know, you're not violating that musculature as much. And so maybe the amount of correction you get sagittally is not, you know, quite as quite as drastic than an open procedure, but you know, I don't think you see the same rates of proximal failures that you do with the open procedures. So, or at least that's been my observation. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm sure there's times, obviously, if you need central decompression, you have to go centrally, but if it's not necessary, you avoid it.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's another thing that's also evolved as well, because, you know, when you think about, and, you know, nowadays when I give, I'm asked to give a talk to summarize like minimally invasive surgery, you know, especially in the setting of degen operations, is really your surgeries of the disc space, like how to access the disc space in a least disruptive fashion. You know, it can be anterior, it can be lateral, could be still an MIST lift, because at minimum, you're just disrupting one facet, and then you're getting into disc space through Kamen's triangle. You can do all those operations without having to get anywhere near the canal. And so a lot of what we do with degen surgery, if you can, is this whole idea of indirect decompression. And, you know, kind of the simplest, or I think the most common example is, you know, your kind of bedrock indication for a lumbar fusion to begin with, something like someone who has like a grade 1 or 2 spondylolisthesis at L4-5. A lot of times they don't really have central stenosis. They have lateral recess stenosis and bilateral foraminal stenosis, more from the listhesis than kind of the typical lumbar spinal stenosis you think of, where you just have like ligament hypertrophy and you have hypertrophy of the superior articulated process that shrinks, that gives you the lateral recess stenosis. So in those cases with spondylolisthesis, you know, if you're able to reduce the spondylolisthesis, if you're able to reconstruct the disc space, a lot of times you're able to indirectly decompress the canal and the foramen. And so you can get it, if someone has, you know, clear radicular symptoms or neurogenic claudication, you can restore that without ever having to look at the fecal sac or a nerve root or anything like that. So that's also a part of kind of the evolution of, especially for minimally invasive fusions.
So in your practice, and just in general, have you seen a shift in outcomes? Can you talk a little bit about open versus MIS approaches when it comes to long-term and short-term outcomes in these patients?
Yeah, so I think for the most part, the long-term outcomes, you know, when you look at things like different patient-reported outcomes, return to work, things like that, you know, beyond a year or two, they're fairly equivocal. And I think, part of it is just you're achieving a solid fusion, you're reducing like the listhesis, or you're restoring foramel height, things like that. I think the gain is a bit more in the short term, you know, whether or not, you know, how long the person's hospital stay is, how quickly you can wean them off opiates, which is an important thing nowadays. And then what's the, you know, you're trying to limit the amount of functional derangement just as a result of surgery. And that's something with a minimally invasive approach, it's easier to do. Now, I mean, you are able to still push that a little bit with open surgeries as well. So I don't know if it's not specific just to the minimally invasive techniques. I think a lot of our thinking, especially with the different ERAS, enhanced recovery after surgery pathways, are stressing a lot of these things. So even open fusion patients can benefit from these ideas and these practices. So, but I think with the minimally invasive, you know, the patient's in less pain from, you know, the exposure, what have you, then it helps to mobilize them quicker and hasten their recovery.
Then you alluded to a few other things that certainly can affect outcomes. And I don't know if there's any specific data about proximal junctional kyphosis. And the other thing you mentioned, that if you're not seeing the fecal sac, the chances of spinal fluid leaks are probably quite a bit lower.
Right. It's pretty much zero. And so, I mean, that it's, you know, I think it's funny because, you know, the way that I approach certain pathologies, you know, when I was in training, you know, it's kind of like you're an orthopedic surgeon, you would do anything to do to avoid looking at the dura. And, you know, I'm kind of doing that right now just because, you know, if I don't have to look at a nerve root, I don't have to look at the thecal sac to achieve what I need to do for the patient, then I'll do that because then, you know, you don't have to worry about epidural scarring later. And, you know, just your risk of a nerve injury or a CSF leak is essentially zero with these types of cases. You do introduce yourself to other types of complications that are, you know, for instance, you know, in these lateral approaches, you know, you can have great vessel injury. You know, you have the there's risk of lumbar plexus injury. So, you know, so some of the kind of the purists, the, you know, old school surgeons, you know, they don't think the lateral approaches are worth, you know, the, you know, you're training one set of complications for another. And then whether or not it's a good trade-off is kind of, you know, it is debatable depending on what your point of view is.
What's your sort of workflow in order to minimize those complications that up until recently haven't been a part of something that a neurosurgeon may or may not have to take care of?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is just paying attention to all of the relevant anatomy. You know, as you know, as a neurosurgeon, I mean, I remember when I was training, I was a resident, when you looked at an MRI, you were kind of fixated on, you know, if, especially like, let's say you're looking at a lumbar MRI, you're kind of fixated on more or less the canal and the disc, and not the disc like anterior or lateral to the vertebral body, just whatever might be in the canal or the lateral recess. And so when you're looking at, you know, things like an ALIF or a lateral or anterior to psoas, you start looking at the psoas anatomy, you start looking at the great vessel anatomy, you start paying attention to, you know, the pelvis, you know, how, where the iliac crest is kind of sits, things like that. And so it's minimizing the, you know, as far as for the workflow to minimize your complications is just to know what sorts of anatomy is unfavorable for a specific approach. And so it's helpful to know, like, you know, what are the conditions that are ideal for like an MIST lift, for an ALIF, for a lateral transoas, for an anti-psoas. And then, you know, you basically see, you know, what level your pathology is, and what's the patient's anatomy dictating. And, you know, I think in general, most surgeons, they, you know, you want to minimize your risk profile dependent on the anatomy. And then, you know, the great thing with these techniques is, you know, if you're facile at all of them, you've got a lot of options where you can basically pick the path of least resistance where, you know, you're going to have the lowest complication profile, and that'll set you up for success.
I guess for the other side of this talk, are there, or I guess the other side of the title for the talk, the open procedures, are there any things that now you're still just are clear case of something you have to do open? I guess one option, it sounds like you're not doing a lot of pedicle subtraction osteotomies, but if you were something like that, obviously you'd have to do kind of big open approach. But is there anything in your practice that you're still kind of feel like you have to do that kind of old fashioned way?
Yeah, I think the thing I joke with the residents is that the only open surgery I do routinely is a posterior cervical laminectomy infusion. You know, there's not really a great replacement for it within the minimally invasive realm. I mean, I think, you know, if you go back to kind of those principles we touched on, like the ACDF is more or less your minimally invasive surgery for the cervical spine, at least for a fusion or arthroplasty, right? It's probably the least invasive. And so, but the issue is that, you know, the scalability of that operation compared to a posterior approach, you know, when you have to decompress five levels posteriorly, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer if you're going to compare it to an anterior approach. And so, you know, it's so that's, you know, that's probably the last the only open surgery that I do right now, so on a routine basis.
Yeah, you know, as a functional neurosurgeon, I'm not doing as many big spine surgeries as you by any means, but I did a cervical laminoplasty today. So when you're talking about tension bands, that's sort of the correlate for trying to preserve the posterior tension band in the cervical spine.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So Do you ever see MIS completely overtaking and making open surgery a thing of the past?
I think certainly for first-time degen, you know, I think they're really, at least in my mind and in my practice, there's not really much of an application for open in those settings, you know. I think when you're talking about revision surgery, things like that, you know, open will always have a role. But, you know, if someone comes to you with kind of your bread and butter issues, like, you know, herniated disc, lumbar spinal stenosis, usually from lateral recess stenosis, people with, you know, either degenerative spondylolisthesis or an isthmic spondylolisthesis, you know, that's probably, you know, 2/3 of this pathology that most, you know, community neurosurgeons will see. All of that can be treated with a minimally invasive approach. And, you know, I think there's equipoise. Some may argue there's some superiority compared to an open approach in a lot of ways. So I think we're already there in that regard. You know, for things like when you start getting outside of that box, which, you know, that's a significant amount of pathology that you can treat with that. And that's a lot of people you're helping with that. But things like, you know, abscesses, you know, epidural abscess, osteomyelitis, you know, intradural type lesions, you know, those are still things where you need to have some of those open techniques just to be able to get the exposure and things like that. And, you know, with oncology, you know, for primary bone tumors, especially, you know, you still need, you know, sometimes it's still, you know, if you need to have like an en bloc spondylectomy, that's, you know, it's hard to do that minimally invasively. The fixation, you can do hybrid type approaches where, you know, you can do, you know, percutaneous or, you know, transfascial type smaller incision to do your instrumentation. You don't have to strip everything out. But, you know, it's, you know, a lot of it just is what, wherever the pathology dictates.
I think you mentioned in passing that are you using robotics now for your percutaneous screws when you're using anterior approaches?
Yeah, so we acquired a robot back at the end of 2019. And for me, I was totally bought in on the idea of using robotics for thoracolumbar instrumentation. So I basically haven't done a case without it since December 2019. So I actually did like my 400th robot case like a week or two ago. And there's definitely been, you know, there's a learning curve to it and there's some kinks to it, but I think for me the biggest thing is you offload your cognitive load when you do that, because, you know, you don't have to worry about you don't have to have all of your concentration to do the screws now. I mean, you need to be paying attention when you're planning them and things like that, but just to execute that part of the operation gets streamlined significantly. And so, a lot of the most challenging stuff we do now is with the cages, or, you know, if you need to do like a decompression or an osteotomy, and, you know, those take a lot of kind of effort and concentration. And then when you get to the point where you have the screws, you know, the funny thing is, like, now the screws is the easy part, you know, where, you know, people 10, 20 years ago, that was still a significant, you know, thing you had to worry about, you know, putting a screw in the right place. And with the robot and navigation, things like that, all of that's streamlined and simplified. So you can kind of offload your mental focus to other things, and, you know, you get a little bit of a break during the operation toward the end. So I've been a big fan of it. You know, it's hard to see going back at this point.
And then, you know, as we're kind of getting close to the time to wrap up, I thought we might talk briefly just about the healthcare costs associated with more minimally invasive approaches versus open. Do you feel like there's a big difference, or are they equivalent?
Well, it kind of depends on your point of view, right? So if you look at just total healthcare, like resource utilization, you know, I mean, there, you know, for some of the technologies, there's some upfront costs, like, you know, like robotics, that's expensive, right? Image guidance, that's all expensive. The implants are more or less a wash. Most institutions have some sort of capitated pricing where you're not paying a premium for minimally invasive implants anymore. And so those things have washed out. I mean, if you have, you know, shorter operative times, you have shorter length of stay, you know, you have less resource utilization from that standpoint. But the funny thing is that, you know, when you look at like the economics of the health system, you know, when you downgrade a lumbar fusion to an outpatient operation, so you have less than a 2-midnight stay, let's say, the reimbursement from the payer side to the facility becomes a lot less. And so, as opposed to if it was an inpatient operation, irrespective of like what it costs to use, during the if someone still stays overnight, like one night in the hospital, but if the payer deems it as an inpatient stay versus an outpatient stay, you know, the reimbursement to the system is significantly different. Whereas, you know, I think most people will say that if you're doing outpatient posterior lumbar fusions in a hospital setting, that's going to be a net loss for the system, as opposed to if it's coded as an inpatient surgery. Now, I mean, I'm sure you guys are aware, you know, when you do a outpatient surgery in a hospital and then the person still stays overnight, it's essentially like an inpatient stay, right? But the nuance is how the payer codes it and then what they pay out to the institution, to your system, is going to be different. And so I think that's something where, you know, I wasn't aware of this, you know, when I was younger. Now, I mean, I'm kind of taking on some more administrative responsibilities nowadays, but it's a bit of a paradox, because I used to think like, yeah, you know, I get my patient out, you know, within a day, I'm saving the hospital all this money because they're not staying in the hospital and, you know, this and that. But, you know, it's like any of these things, it's a little bit nuanced, you know, depending on the payer. I mean, definitely for CMS, I think it's a net minus. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma to be in.
Yeah, that really is. And the incentives might not be quite what you would expect they would be. Obviously, if you're doing things in an ASC and sending people home that would otherwise be in a hospital, that's sort of, you know, pretty much a net win for the healthcare system, I would guess, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, totally for like just what you're costing society, let's say, is going to be less, right? But whether or not that gives you profitability, you know, if you're doing it in a hospital still versus like an ASC or somewhere where you have less overhead, then, you know, it may not wash out for your healthcare system, you know. And so, but, you know, let's say overall societal cost is going to be less, right? So it just kind of depends on, like I said, it depends on what your point of view is.
Well, I think that's a good place we can end it, unless Preston, you had any other thoughts before we call it. Okay, well then we'll call it in there. And you know, thank you again, Dr. Cheng, so much for your input and your insight on this subject. And it sounds like something you've thought about quite a lot, and it's really a big part of your practice. To our listeners, thank you very much for listening. Please check out cns.org for lots of other educational content. Again, I'm Seth Oliveira, and then I'm joined by Rashan Ali. And again, thank you, Dr. Cheng. And we'll end there. Thanks.